Hello and welcome to the Journal of Zoology podcast. In this episode, we'll be looking at papers published during the months of January, February and March. We will hear from our Editor-in-Chief, Nigel Bennett, who will discuss two papers he found particularly interesting and excellent examples of the sort of research that we aim to publish. And I speak with authors Joseph Kolowski, Andrew King, Claire Hawkins and Peter Lindsay to learn a little more about what they have discovered during their studies. The first paper Nigel chose to highlight is entitled Restricted Ranging Behaviour in a High-Density Population of Urban Badgers by John Davison, Tim Roper, Maren Huck and Richard Delahaye. Over to you, Nigel.
Now, in the face of urban development, many species either retreat or they become locally extinct. However, others have done really surprisingly well in these altered environments. This includes the badger, which is the focus of the paper. And this particular paper was studied by radio-tracking individual badgers within a population occurring around the Brighton suburbs. What I liked about this paper was the incredible amount of effort that went into recording the observations and the movements of these badgers, and also some of the really surprising results that came out of it. For example, the density of badgers in this area was very high. It showed some of the smallest groups that had ever been recorded, and also the individual home ranges of the species were extremely small. And at first, this really puzzled me when I read the paper before I sent it out for review, because I thought, this is unusual. We've got badgers occurring in an environment, very high density, small groups, and yet they've got incredibly small home ranges. Now, as a definition of what an urban area constitutes, it is difficult to make generalizations about how living in close proximity to humans and their dwellings can actually influence wild archivals. But this study emphasizes that some species can actually become hugely and widely adaptable. And while relaxed social behavior and small home ranges seem to be a common response, other studies previously on badger populations in the Bristol area, for example, have shown in the 1980s that these badger populations are actually in a very low density, and they could be compared with those almost of rural occurring badgers. Not only that, it also has implications for future research and for future development. Now, as you know, as development continues and as the population in Britain increases, so there's going to be further urbanization of previously rural habitats. And this is more so, for example, in the UK, which is a very small country, but also has other serious implications worldwide for other badger populations which occur in Europe. Obviously, as urbanization and development takes place in these rural areas, what we tend to find is that species are going to either have to adapt or retreat. And I feel that this study provided an incredibly valuable addition to the growing body of literature on this topic. And I think hopefully this will contribute in future to carnivore conservation in general and into mammal conservation globally as well. So I really found this paper to be informative, interesting, exciting and well executed. And I think it made an extremely valuable contribution to the Journal of Zoology.
So in conclusion, Davison et al.'s paper suggests that the effects of urbanisation can vary among different populations of the same species. Therefore, before any conservation and management decisions are made involving urban carnivores, a detailed study of the relevant local population is required. Nigel's second choice was the paper by Abigail McFarlane and Graham Coulson, Boys Will Be Boys, Social Affinity Among Males Drives Social Segregation in the Western Grey Kangaroo.
This paper I found really, really enjoyable and interesting because it was very, very hypothesis driven, but it also had very large implications for not only the species under study, but for other species in general. And this was a study looking at the social segregation in Western Grey Kangaroos. Now, sexually dimorphic and polygynous species often show extreme social segregation, whereby individuals preferentially associate with members of the same sex outside of the breeding season. There are several hypotheses as to why this pattern should be observed. And what I liked about this paper was that McFarlane and Coulson went on to test within a population of socially segregated Western Grey Kangaroos a number of hypotheses to which the segregation could be taken into account. They found in this study that while females and small males and even large males left mixed sex groups, it was the large males that joined existing all-male groups more than expected by chance, suggesting that one of the hypotheses that they had quoted, that being the male social affinity hypothesis, was the most likely explanation. Now, why should males join all male groups? Well, under this hypothesis, males joining all male groups can effectively keep tabs on future potential rivals in the mating season. It also allows for them to practice fighting skills, and you all know that kangaroos do a fair amount of boxing. This hypothesis also seems to be able to explain social segregation in certain ungulates, on other continents even, so it's got widespread ramifications. And it's also supported by previous observations by the same researchers that male grey kangaroos indeed do form groups in open areas where visual assessment and observation of fighting bouts are much easier than would naturally be occurring in woodland areas. This paper implies that the males gain information on competitors and likely can assess their position in a hierarchy of male-male competition in upcoming breeding seasons and can even influence the fighting bouts which take place. Now, what I liked about this paper, particularly for the Journal of Zoology, was that the authors went through each hypothesis carefully. They did careful statistics on their results, and they finally were able to dismiss a number of the hypotheses which had been proposed previously for segregation among species, and they were able to support the male social affinity hypothesis. So, in hindsight, both of these papers which I've looked at, I found them to be the type of manuscript which we're looking for the journal, well written and well executed.
If you would like to submit to the journal, please visit our online submission site at mc.manuscriptcentral.com/JZO, where you'll find full upload instructions and support available. The presence of large carnivores is often critical to the function of a normal ecosystem. Their predatory activities create an impact that ripple down through the food chain. However, due to the ever-increasing intrusion into their natural habitats by humans, large carnivores are in decline. To ensure that they are conserved in the most effective way, there is a real need to understand how ecological factors affect the space use decisions they make, specifically the changes they may make in response to disturbance and the costs associated with these changes. In my first interview for this episode of the podcast, I spoke to Joseph Kalowski, who along with Kay Holkamp, both of the Department of Zoology at the Michigan State University, investigated the ecological factors influencing space use in two hyena clans in Kenya. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Could you start by telling us a bit more about the problems large carnivores are facing in the wild?
Well, there's a lot of them, but the two primary ones would be habitat loss to human development and agriculture. And then the other one would be direct conflict between large carnivores and humans. And this can be a lot of different things. In case like something like a tiger, it can be commercial hunting for skin and for body parts. But for most large carnivores, this conflict is related to livestock depredation. And so this is where you have carnivore species that are killing livestock or thought to be killing livestock. And that results in the retaliatory killing of these carnivores by humans. And this is seen worldwide. You know, you can have snow leopards in Nepal killing yaks and cattle to wolves and coyotes in the western U.S. And then obviously in East Africa, where I was working, you have the hyenas, leopards, and lions being the main source of livestock killing. And so what this does is it basically creates a situation where the humans are unwilling to share their lands with these large carnivores. And in the end, or a large portion of the mortality of a lot of these large carnivores is direct killing from humans as a result.
We hear a lot about big cats and other of the larger mammals and how their numbers are dwindling. Has human disturbance affected hyena populations to the same extent?
Well, relative to some of the other carnivores that hyenas live with, like lions and cheetahs, spotted hyenas have fared relatively well. They're very resilient, they're very flexible in their behavior, very opportunistic foragers, and so their populations are doing better than some of these other large carnivores, but they've still suffered a lot of habitat loss, like all large carnivore populations. And they also get into trouble because they're so opportunistic. So when you have hyena populations that are living near human populations, there's often going to be direct interaction because hyenas seek out any type of food that they can find. And so we know in the reserve that we worked in the Masai Mara, from following hyenas, that they would often spend a large portion of the nighttime wandering through villages that were outside the reserve. And what we think they're doing is basically just looking for garbage, looking for old livestock carcasses and things like that. And occasionally they're being opportunistic and they're taking live livestock. And so because hyenas are so opportunistic like this, they tend to get themselves into problems. We also know that in terms of specific reactions to human disturbance, some of the previous research I did showed that in areas where you have a lot of livestock, the hyenas are becoming more and more nocturnal. So that's one of the sort of behavioral changes that you'll see when there's human disturbance.
In your paper, you make reference to a number of studies that have looked at different ecological factors and shown that carnivores tend to avoid areas characterized by intense human activity or disturbance. So what new information did you hope to gain from this study?
Two things, basically. First, in a general sense, we wanted to see what ecological things determined where you would find spotted hyenas in their territory. From day to day, why did you see hyenas in one area and not another? And we know generally from previous research that prey was important, that hyenas are generally found in areas where prey densities are the highest in their territory. But there hadn't been a real study that looked at all the possible ecological factors together in a multivariate sort of comprehensive sense. And then second, we wanted to see how that whole relationship changed when you add intense daily livestock grazing into a hyena's territory. You know, the situation there in the reserve was such that you have clans in the center of the reserve that are unexposed to livestock grazing, and then you have other clans on the borders that are exposed to this livestock grazing inside the reserve, which is illegal. And so we had a sort of situation where we could do a comparative study and look at what hyenas are doing on the border of the reserve compared to hyenas in the same reserve, you know, that weren't exposed to livestock at all.
And how did you monitor the animals in your study?
For the hyenas, we had about 30 radio collars, about half those hyenas in one study clan and half in another. And we tracked them during all times of the day and night. So that's how we got a big data set in terms of describing where the hyenas were. And then we also had to monitor prey resources. So we would drive sections of road within both of the clan territories, counting prey within 100 meters of the road transects. We did that four or five times a month. And then you could interpolate that into basically a map of prey distribution for every month of the study. And we did the same thing for livestock, except we actually tried to count all the head of livestock inside these hyena clan territories on a regular basis.
Now, you mentioned earlier that some of the previous research you had done had shown hyenas becoming more nocturnal in areas where there was high livestock presence. Now, I know that East Africa is different from many places in that rather than grazing unguarded, livestock is usually accompanied by herders who obviously pose a direct threat to carnivores. And I'm guessing this may be why we're seeing the hyenas retreating until darkness. So with regards to livestock presence, can you explain the differences you expected to see between your two study clans?
Well, in one of our clan study areas, Dr. Kay Holkamp at Michigan State University has been having researchers there with herself studying these hyenas in this one clan for more than 15 years. And so over these years, the researchers have noticed that it's been more and more difficult to actually observe the hyenas. It seems like these hyenas have used open areas a lot less is one of the big differences. So based on some of these expected behavioral changes, we made a couple predictions. So if we were to compare the space use of this study clan, which is on the border of the reserve and exposed to livestock, to our sort of control group in the center of the reserve, then we expected that this control group would be found out in open grassland more often, that they wouldn't be selecting for this vegetative cover like the other hyenas seem to be doing.
Yeah.
We also predicted that these hyenas that weren't exposed to livestock, that their space use would be more closely related to where the prey were in their territory, that they would be able to use their territory in a more optimal fashion. And finally, and on a real basic level, we expected that in the disturbed clan with the livestock grazing, that the locations of those hyenas would be related to where the livestock were. That areas where the most intense livestock grazing was, we would find the hyenas there less often.
Okay, and did you look at any other factors?
Well, we had to take into account everything that we thought might influence hyena space use.
Mm.
And one of the things that we know is going to be important is where the communal den was. And hyenas raise all their cubs together in a communal den, and the cubs live there for the first 8 to 12 months of their life. And this communal den is sort of a social center for even the adult males in the clan that don't help raise the cubs. All the hyenas come to this den on a regular basis to socialize. So we had to keep track of where the den was, obviously. And then we also incorporated variables like vegetation type throughout the territory, where the streams were. And so on top of those variables and the prey, livestock, we thought we had covered most of the main ecological factors that might be involved.
Mm. And did your results agree with your predictions? And what differences did you see between the two clans?
Some of our results did agree with the predictions. For example, the animals in the control clan, their locations were much more closely related to where the prey were in the territory compared to the livestock grazing clan. So they did seem to be able to select areas where there were more prey more easily than these animals that were exposed to livestock. We also found that, like we predicted, these animals in the control clan were found much more often in open grassland, whereas the animals exposed to livestock were selecting areas with dense vegetative cover. So those were what we predicted. But to our surprise, we didn't find a relationship between livestock use and hyena space use in this clan on the border of the reserve. So the probability of a hyena using a part of its territory was totally unrelated to how intensely grazed that part of the territory was. Some other differences that we saw were in their use of the area near the den. We found that the undisturbed hyenas were found, their space use was much more closely associated with where their den was than the hyenas that were dealing with livestock grazing. That if you were to put a map up of all the locations, you could really predict where the den was based on the clustering of locations in one area. And you couldn't really do that in this other clan on the border of the reserve.
So what did you conclude from your data with regards to hyena space use, and how can this information be used to guide future conservation efforts?
Well, we found basically that all the variables we looked at were important. If you're looking at hyenas that are unexposed to livestock, by far the most important predictor of where the hyenas were is where their den was. Mm-hmm. And that, as I said, was very different in this clan that was exposed to livestock. The thing of most concern was that although where the prey were and where the den was still influenced hyenas that were exposed to livestock, it was a much weaker association. And that brings into a concern of energetic implications, where if these hyenas are not able to spend a lot of time near the den and spend time in the areas where the prey are, then that could result in, over time, a much higher energy expenditure, particularly for nursing mothers that have to come to the den multiple times a day. They're not comfortable resting near the den during the day. If they're not comfortable hanging out where the prey are hanging out, then over time that could have fairly serious implications in terms of energetics. And then in terms of what effect this is having on the hyenas, interestingly, it doesn't seem to be yet having a demographic effect on this clan. So over the past 10 years, the livestock grazing has been increasing pretty steadily, but we haven't noticed any demographic changes in this clan in terms of things like clan size, cub survival and recruitment. Everything seems to be more or less fine in terms of these metrics. And so what we think is that the fact that there's adequate vegetation cover in this territory is allowing the hyenas to continue to use the same areas as livestock without really suffering any dramatic impact. And in terms of conservation implications, the real big concern is that if that's the case, if they're really relying on this vegetation cover to continue using the same space, then outside the reserve, where there's a lot of overgrazing, you also have harvesting of wood for charcoal, for firewood, there's a lot less vegetative cover out there. And we would predict that, based on our findings, that out there, the hyenas would, in fact, start to abandon habitat that is otherwise suitable to them. They would start to abandon that habitat if you start getting livestock grazing there. And it points to the fact that although these animals are really flexible and resilient, if you have an area where there's no vegetative refugia, these animals are going to start abandoning the areas.
So up until now, it seems that hyenas have managed to escape the wrath of human disturbance that is causing so many other large carnivore populations to decline. But just how much longer they can survive the increasing threats remains to be seen. To read Joseph and Kay's study, Ecological and Anthropogenic Influences on Space Use by Spotted Hyenas, in full, please see the January 2009 issue of the journal. On the cover of the February issue, we had an excellent image of a Chacma baboon, provided by Andrew King, who, along with Guy Cowlishaw, both based here at the Institute of Zoology in London, published their research on the interspecific association seen between these baboons and rock kestrels. The organisation and stability of biological communities results from the interactive relationships that arise between populations of different species. These interactions can range from antagonistic to cooperative and can have either positive, negative, or neutral effects on the species involved. Andrew, can you describe the different types of interspecific associations that can be formed?
Okay, well, basically, first of all, associations can be a byproduct of foraging or movement patterns of two species, so it doesn't necessarily have to have any functional significance. However, quite often you get associations which do have significance, and they can be categorized according to the benefits or the costs that arise for the two species involved. So you can have mutualism, where it involves both species getting something out of the association. For example, when two species will benefit better from detecting a predator, for example. You can have parasitism, which most people will instantly recognize, where one species benefits from the association and the other incurs a cost. So viruses and bacteria are classic examples. And then the last one is you can have commensalism, which is where one species benefits and the other is completely unaffected. And this is the category where most bird primate species associations come under, like the study which we did.
And had there been much research done on bird primate associations before your study?
There's been a fair bit of research done. Most associations, as I mentioned, appear to be commensal. And what happens is the birds associate with the primates because the primates are moving through the vegetation and they're disturbing lots of prey, typically insects. So insects will bounce into the air from the vegetation as they're disturbed, so it makes it easier for the birds to prey upon them. So that's the kind of associations which have been looked at. And the research has basically shown that most of the associations occur most frequently when there's high insect abundance, which makes perfect sense. But not very many studies have investigated how the behavior of the primates themselves influence the bird associations. And most of the studies have also been conducted in the tropics of South America.
So how does this study add to what we already know?
The study which we did looked at kestrel baboon associations, which hasn't been documented before. And it's also in Namibia in Africa, which is another point which there hasn't been very much studied then.
What were your hypotheses and predictions?
Our hypothesis was that these associations are not chance events, but occur because the kestrels are actually receiving a benefit from associating with the baboons, which is catching these insects, crickets and locusts in the case of the baboons, which we looked at. So we tested a bunch of predictions. The first one was that the kestrels should associate with the baboons when there are lots of insects. So in this case, it was following summer rains because they both live in this dry desert environment. The second prediction was about the kestrels, their behavior. So associations we thought would be more common at the times when kestrels traditionally forage, which is basically not in the hot middle part of the day, so in the morning and the evening. And the last three predictions, which were kind of how we're developing the previous studies, which was to look specifically at the baboon behaviors. So we predicted kestrels would associate with the baboons when they were in very open habitat, where we thought the insects would be more common, and also the kestrels would have better chance of seeing and catching any insects which the baboons flush out. The other prediction was that associations should be more common when troops were active. So when a bunch of baboons are all trouncing through the vegetation, then they'll be displacing more insects, and so you'd expect more associations with the kestrels. And then finally was that kestrels should associate with larger baboon troops because, again, in theory, the bigger the troop, the more baboons flushing insects, so the higher the probability of kestrels actually getting an insect flushed for them. So that's the prediction.
Okay, and were your results consistent with your predictions? Was there any factor which stood out as being significant in causing the formation of these associations?
Yeah, happily, we found support for all of our predictions. So the results support previous work, but we also found some nice new results. For example, we were the first to show a group size effect, and also the fact that the kestrels associate with the baboons when the majority of the troop were travel foraging, and that raises some interesting questions about how kestrels are in fact locating the groups and when they choose to associate, so what sort of signals and cues the kestrels are using, because we didn't find that the baboons walking or traveling simply increased the frequency of these associations. It was specifically when they were travel foraging.
So are you carrying out any further studies into this or any other bird primate associations?
Yes, something we weren't able to pull out of our data was the actual foraging benefit derived by the kestrels. So although our data shows nice relationships in the directions we predicted and support the hypothesis that kestrels actually increase their foraging intake, we couldn't actually measure that bit. So we couldn't measure how kestrels are doing when they're associating with the baboons versus where they're not associating with the baboons. So we're looking to see if we can actually get some more observations of the kestrels when they're foraging without the baboons.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard to find the kestrels when you're not with the baboons, which is incredibly frustrating. But at the same time, it's kind of reassuring because it emphasizes the fact that these relationships are in fact active associations, not just chance events. So yeah, that's the next stage of the research.
Okay, well, good luck with your research and thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Next, I speak to Claire Hawkins, author of one of the papers published in our March issue, focusing on an unusual mating system seen in a somewhat unusual creature. Cat-like in appearance, with a round muzzle, pronounced ears, paws with claws, and an exceptionally long tail, the fossa has puzzled scientists ever since its discovery in 1830.
Anyone looking at a fossa will immediately try to start saying what it's like, and they get very stuck. Cats and dogs generally get mentioned, but people get very confused, and that's the same with the taxonomists. In recent years, it's been mostly called a civet, but actually, in most recent times, it seems to be heading towards its own special family, which it shares with a bunch of other odd-looking carnivores, all based in Madagascar. So the fossa is the largest terrestrial animal in Madagascar. Its body is 70 centimetres long, the tail's the same again, it's about 6.5 kilos. And it's kind of half terrestrial, half arboreal, depending on the style of forest it's living in. And it is very much dependent on forests, and it primarily preys on lemurs.
So how did you come about studying the mating system of the fossa?
Well, I was very interested in general in looking at an animal that was a bit of a one-off and finding out how a bunch of behavioural ecological theories bore out whether we can actually just explain everything about mammal behaviour through their ecology. Have we got to that stage yet, or how far are we there? And, you know, of course I was intrigued because the fossa had a number of strange stories about it. And I had heard that there was this rather unusual mating system, which was described to me as some kind of lek, where there's a lot of animals all grouped together in a tree. I also was told about the possibility of some sort of female masculinization of the genitalia, which turned out to be another interesting aspect of the fossas. So I was particularly curious to find out what was really going on with the mating system and what might be driving it.
Obviously, there's been a lot of work done on mating strategies, and I think I'm right in saying that for male mammals, these strategies have long been treated as fairly predictable on the basis of two factors. Firstly, as suggested by Emlyn and Oren in their classic paper, Ecology, Sexual Selection and the Evolution of Mating Systems, the distribution of females is key. And secondly, if the provision of paternal care by the male benefits his reproductive success, then this will also affect the strategy used. With the fossa being solitary, obviously paternal care doesn't play a role, but did you use Emlyn and Oren's theory to try and predict why the fossas were behaving as they did? Or are there any more recent theories that can help to explain it better?
When I was trying to figure out what was going on with fossas, there were two key indicators I had of what I might expect. Clutton Brock took Emlyn and Oren's work, and he summed it up in terms of the defensibility of a female's home range. So if a female's home range was defensible, then a male would establish an exclusive territory around one or more female's territories, and he would have some sort of bond with those. He would know where they were and be able to predictably find them during mating time. If a female's territory was not defensible, then the male would be forced into a much more sort of haphazard setup where he'd have to just kind of wander around looking for females wherever luck would take him. And the other approach that I investigated was that of Mikhail Sandel, who'd actually really focused on solitary carnivores and why they were solitary and how they were spaced and also their mating system. And he had a similar understanding that they might be what he called roamers or stayers, so whether they defended an exclusive territory or wandered around. But instead of looking at the defensibility of female home ranges, he actually explained it in terms of the density of the population. So if for the body weight of the animal, the population was denser on average than your typical solitary carnivore, then you'd expect to have a stayer. And if they were less dense, then you'd expect to have a roamer. And the cool thing with the fossa was that it was sort of in the middle, because the territory of the female appears to be defensible in that the female herself defends a territory. She has an exclusive territory, mm-hmm. and it's smaller than that of the male. But fossas are really very low density for their body weight for the typical carnivore group.
Now, you said earlier that you're intrigued to study these animals, partly because of the strange stories that you'd heard about their mating activities. So what exactly did you see when you witnessed this for yourself in the wild?
Basically, there seems to be a female who spends quite a while, pretty much all the time that she's involved in mating, up this tree. There were actually more than one site involved when I was watching it, and I've heard of other sites, but they're all along a dry river. And the time of the year that mating takes place is where water is at a very limited resource, and one would imagine that it's a very sensible place to find a mate, because everyone is going to be focused on that very limited water. So they're right beside this water, female's up a tree, and then an accumulating number of males circling around the area, scrapping with each other, one every now and then ascending the tree, sometimes mating with a female, sometimes not. And it's all quite noisy, and for me, absolutely fantastic, because for the whole of the rest of the time I was studying fossas, I only saw them in traps, and suddenly these things are amazing in the trees. It was an incredibly fantastic sight to see them doing their thing. It was great.
So, from your observations, did the behaviour of the males more closely follow the theory proposed by Clutton Brock or the theory proposed by Sandel?
I was trying to find out whether they were roamers or stayers. And I had a bit of a clue that they were probably not roamers already, because I've been doing a bit of radio tracking and the home ranges weren't exclusive, so it didn't look like they were defending a bunch of female territories. But also, there were, you know, a number of males around this area, and there was There's no indication whatsoever that the males were succeeding in defending a female for themselves, except for a very short time. But apart from that, they weren't really succeeding in kind of defending a female long term. So they certainly seemed to be roamers rather than stayers. So Sandel scored a point there.
And the behaviour of the females, how did that compare to other mammals?
The female mating system was not really typical of anything I'd seen before. You know, obviously I started reading about every single mating system, trying to fit this in, but there'd be one female and she would mate multiply. And then after some days, a second female came and quite neatly and with no aggression whatsoever replaced the first female. And this happened a second time as well. So I saw basically three females mating multiply with an array of males who didn't change very much. And obviously there's always this interest about females mating multiply. It's not an obvious thing females would need to do. You would have thought that one quick interaction would be sufficient to fertilize all their eggs. But obviously there are some advantages which people have been working through, such as having a genetic variation within the young. And there's a whole bunch of other, I could go on and on about the various reasons, but it'll probably take quite a while to figure out which holds.
So essentially, females appear to monopolise a site, maximise the available number of mates, and mate multiply. However, the reasoning behind this unique strategy is still not clear. Are you carrying out any further research on the foster or other solitary carnivores to better explain mammalian mating systems?
Well, yes, I mean, I did obviously try and make sense of what was going on with the fossa, and one of the things, some of the other work I did suggest that there might be a bit of a sexual harassment issue with the fossa, perhaps because they're such low-density animals that you can imagine that a male would really jump on a female if he found one. And so obviously when she's up in the tree, she really has a lot of control over the situation, and that was very apparent. She was very much in control. But yes, I go through a bunch of ideas and possible interpretations of what was going on. But it would be very hard to actually test what the true explanation is. Certainly, fossas seen as a whole have a really unusual array of features. I actually later came to Tasmania, initially to work on the spotted-tailed quoll, which ecologically is extremely similar to the fossa. And I was really curious to see what features it might share. But no such luck so far. They don't have female genital masculinization either. So I don't know. As I say, I just firmed up the conclusion so far that we certainly don't understand everything about mammalian behavioural ecology yet.
That's very true. There's always something new to learn. To read Claire's paper, A Novel Mating System in a Solitary Carnivore, the Fossa, in full, please see the March issue of the journal. In 2008, the journal appointed a new reviews editor, Dr. Stephen Lacomba of Queen Mary University of London, and we now have a series of review papers awaiting publication over the coming months. In the February issue, Peter Lindsay of the University of Pretoria presented his paper, which discusses the huge shift in recent decades away from livestock ranching towards game ranching in southern Africa due to changes in legislation. I recently spoke to Peter, who explained in a little more depth how these changes have affected large mammal conservation in this area.
There were a couple of major changes that had big implications for wildlife conservation on private land. They were effective ownership of wildlife was granted to landowners in several southern African countries, and also the right to hunt wildlife. And what this did was it made wildlife have a very significant financial value to landowners, whereas previously it was just a financial liability because wildlife would break fences or kill livestock. So there was a big change. And that had the effect of very quickly changing attitudes of landowners towards wildlife and resulted in a massive shift from livestock ranching towards wildlife ranching.
So with such huge changes in land use, what impact did this have on wildlife populations? And was the transition beneficial for conservation?
Okay, well, the benefits were pretty obvious since there was suddenly a massive increase in the abundance and distribution of wildlife occurring on private land. This was due to mass reintroductions of wildlife species throughout the different game ranching areas, also through greater protection from poaching and other threats of wildlife that already occurred on ranches. Livestock was removed, so the overgrazing that had typified a lot of the grasslands gradually disappeared and the bush started to recover from the negative environmental impact of overstocking with livestock. So there was, generally speaking, a big increase in the abundance and diversity of wildlife on private land and the recovery of overgrazed veld and ecosystems. There were, however, a number of problems associated with game ranching from an environmental point of view. These problems certainly don't exceed the benefits, but they do prevent game ranching from being the conservation tool that it could be. And to list a few of these problems, one is the unregulated movement of wildlife such that a variety of exotic species were introduced, or what we call extralimital species, where species were moved within the same country but beyond their historical distribution. That was quite common. In Namibia and South Africa and Botswana, there was a legal requirement for game ranches to be fenced, for ranchers to gain the user rights over wildlife. And what this did is it had the effect of converting ranch land into small fenced pockets, which disrupted natural processes such as migration and predation to some extent. And what we found is on these small fenced game ranches, ranchers often overstock them, put too much wildlife on them in some cases, such that they became overgrazed. And also, because the wild ungulates became so valuable to hunting, very often ranchers were intolerant of predators, so species such as lions, wild dogs, cheetahs, and so forth, widely persecuted on ranch land. Yeah, on these small fenced pockets, generally speaking, the land uses would revolve around high offtake meat hunting and boar hunting, which results in a removal of quite significant proportion of the ungulate population every year, which meant there was no proportion remaining for the predators, which is another reason why the predators were not tolerated generally. And also those fenced ranches require very intensive management in response to things like changing environmental circumstances like droughts and fires. They're small. They can look after fairly small populations of ungulates, which are prone to all of the problems associated with small population sizes, such as inbreeding and demographic and environmental and genetic stochasticity. So that's to list a few of the problems. Certainly don't outweigh the benefit, but there are problems.
Is there any way in which we can overcome these problems? Because from what you said, the conservation value of game ranching is clear, but it seems that it could have greater potential if we could reduce these negative effects in some way.
Yeah, well, there's two ways, really. One is through improved regulation, introducing laws to regulate the reintroduction or introduction of wildlife species such that exotic animals are not introduced or species are not introduced beyond their geographical distribution. And another method would be to facilitate better practices on ranch land. And one of the ways in which that can be done is through promoting the formation of conservancies, which is what the topic of my paper was. So conservancies are, in a nutshell, formed when neighboring game ranches remove internal fencing and typically replace it with a single fence that encompasses a number of different properties so that a large open system is created. And that causes a lot of the problems associated with traditional game ranching to fall away.
So what benefits or improvements in terms of conservation can we expect to see with the formation of these conservancies?
The most obvious ecological benefit is that the larger areas created enable ranchers to introduce complete faunal assemblages. So you can introduce the big species such as elephants, rhinos, lions and so forth that smaller properties can't really deal with. And that's got a couple of major impacts, one of which is that it influences the land use. It gives ranchers the opportunity to move away from the kind of low-value, high-offtake meat hunting or low-value sport hunting towards high-value photographic tourism and high-value trophy hunting, which typically involves quite low offtakes of animal populations. And as a result of this, generally speaking, natural processes such as competition, predation, and migration start to come in to some extent. And also the environmental resilience generally improves. Larger wildlife populations are less vulnerable to stochastic events, be they demographic events or environmental extreme conditions like the loss of grazing through bushfires. A bushfire is unlikely to destroy a whole conservancy, for example, but could quite easily go through a single ranch and destroy all of the grazing on that property. Another issue is when ranchers form conservancies, they very often develop MOUs or agreements on how to be managed. And very often those agreements are much more in line with wildlife conservation than the management styles of individual ranchers, who sometimes can be fairly whimsical in terms of how they manage wildlife because they don't really understand principles of ecology or conservation or because they don't really care. But when you have a group of ranchers forming a conservancy, there'll generally be some kind of agreement which will have the input of a professional ecologist or conservationist in there and will help to make sure that the management abides by conservation principles.
And can ranchers benefit financially in any way from joining a conservancy?
Yeah, there's significant financial benefits associated with reintroducing the big wildlife, or specifically the big five, which is buffalo, one of the two rhino species, elephants, leopards, and lions. And when you have those species in addition to the other diversity that goes on African savannas. You can start marketing much more upmarket ecotourism, photographic tourism, and also high-end trophy hunting of those animals. And as a result, the returns are generally anywhere between 3 and 10 or even more times higher than there would be for a game ranch that just has the antelope species on. And as a result of being able to have these more profitable land uses, the value of land also increases significantly. In South Africa, for example, land that has the Big Five on it generally goes for about 6 times what land without the Big Five goes for. And finally, from a financial perspective, there are also significant economies of scale associated with having a collaborative management unit. So there's less fencing to erect or to maintain, probably fewer water points. You could probably have fewer lodges.
Okay, so if there are so many benefits, why are we not seeing the formation of a greater number of conservancies? Are there any reasons why ranchers may be reluctant to join?
Well, so there are a few barriers. Perhaps the most obvious one is that there's quite significant start-up costs associated with forming conservancies, developing the external perimeter fence on the outside, for example. Reintroducing wildlife is a significant cost. But beyond the financial issues, having your own ranch, you know, you have complete control over it. You're allowed to manage the wildlife how you like, when you like. Whereas with a conservancy, there are restrictions and agreements and limitations. And so there's generally a need for a strong leader within the community to drive the process of formation. Otherwise, where there's a general apathy or a lack of initiative among a certain ranching community, it's unlikely to spontaneously come about that a conservancy will develop, because it takes a lot of convincing and a lot of reassurance that people are not going to lose the rights to their land and their wildlife and so forth. There's an inequity among different ranches in any given area in terms of ranch infrastructure or investment in wildlife, and there's a fear that if you take fences down, you'll lose all of your valuable wildlife to your neighbor, for example. Or he might then go and hunt it or something. So these are the fears that result in an inertia that make conservancies not happen as frequently as perhaps we'd like.
So how do you think landowners can be encouraged to include their land into conservancies?
I think there's a few ways. First and foremost, I think, is education. And that is educating ranching communities of the potential financial and ecological benefits associated with conservancies and the social benefits. But also education of the fact that the fears that are generally associated with loss of control are often not really grounded, because if you come up with a proper conservancy institution, then, for example, the fear about your neighbor shooting all your wildlife or concern about differential investments in infrastructure and wildlife and so forth. If there's a good conservancy constitution, those kind of issues can be taken into account in differential levies being allocated to different conservancy members depending on what they put in before the conservancy was formed, for example. So, yeah, just education of how conservancies are very beneficial in many ways, and also the perceived drawbacks of conservancies are false in most cases, because you can come up with a constitution that will resolve all of those issues. So education is one. Another is, I think there's a strong case for governments to consider introducing tax breaks to encourage conservancy formation. The reason being that the economic benefits of conservancies versus game ranches are going to be significant, because the earnings are so much higher that even if the tax rates are a bit lower, the tax earnings will still be higher for the government. And also because one of the key social benefits of conservancies is that conservancies form an institutional structure or entity with a much more appropriate scale for interacting with governments and with communities to deal with issues such as land reform and things like that, whereas individual ranches are not really equipped to deal with those kind of challenges. So there are certainly significant benefits for government to consider tax breaks. Another way in which conservancies could be encouraged would be if NGOs would consider helping to sponsor some of the startup costs, because they'd certainly be a very good investment from a conservation perspective, because once the startup costs are paid for or contributed to, then the conservation benefits thereafter will be self-sustaining and will be significant. And then finally, the other potential initiatives, such as in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, there's what's called the Ezimvelo KwaZulu-Natal Black Rhino Project, in which provincial wildlife authorities give custodianship to conservancies over black rhinos. And then if the landowners look after those rhinos properly, then they get a proportion of the offspring of those rhinos, which are obviously quite valuable. Mm. And so those kind of schemes act as a potential incentive for ranchers to get together and form a conservancy rather than sticking with their own small ranches.
So as so often is the case, it is the local people and governments that need to be better informed. They need to be made aware of the possible ecological, financial and social benefits that conservancies could bring. As human populations, habitat fragmentation, and species extinctions continue to increase, conservancies provide an innovative strategy that could help maximise conservation efforts. That's all for now. Thank you for listening, and I hope you join us again for the next episode, in which we'll be looking at the editor's pick of the papers published from April to June, and speaking to Robert Nell about his review on population density and the evolution of male aggression.